From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
This has been around for about 40 years. I tell people all the time, we're in the opportunity business, right? We invest loans and grants, equity and technical assistance in those things that help people in places achieve economic and social mobility. So we invest in creating and preserving affordable housing. We invest in launching and strengthening small businesses. We invest in schools and charter schools and football fields and in low wealth areas and workforce training. Like, that's what we do for a living. We use a business model, but the return is fighting poverty.
Maurice A. Jones, president and CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Jones is the former deputy undersecretary for HUD and the secretary of commerce in Virginia. The Local Initiative Support Corporation is a community development finance organization that provides access to capital, grants, loans, equity investment, tax credit equity, affordable housing, and technical assistance to places like schools, healthcare centers, and organized groups. Founded in 1979 with seed money from the Ford Foundation, LISC is in more places than any other community development organization, with staff, expertise, and relationships in 36 local offices. The organization engages local leaders and neighbors to plan, set goals, and measure progress. They bring local issues to state and national policy leaders. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the Local Initiative Support Corporation with Maurice A. Jones, In Black America.
So I think the pandemic has highlighted at least a couple of areas that we are going to try to really, really intensify our efforts around when it comes to small businesses, particularly small businesses led by Blacks and people of color. One is technology. And I would tell you that's a huge one. And what I mean by that is the pandemic has taught us all that no matter your size or where you are, if you are a business, for profit or not for profit, you need to be able to provide your services and your products via the internet, via some kind of technology. You need an e-commerce play, if you will. And so we want to help more businesses develop and sustain an e-commerce platform.
The Local Initiative Support Corporation has upped this game during this COVID-19 pandemic, working in 35 states and 2,000 rural areas across the nation in housing, economic development, job training, social factors of health, and education, helping people at the margins build stable lives. LISC is the largest community development organization in the country. Since the onset of COVID-19 in mid-March of this year, LISC has raised and invested nearly $200 million to support small businesses run by people of color and women all across the nation. In September of 2016, Maurice A. Jones was appointed president and CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Prior to joining LISC, Jones was the Secretary of Commerce and Trade for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Also, he previously served as Deputy Undersecretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development from April 2012 through January 2014. Recently, In Black America spoke with Maurice A. Jones.
Well, I grew up in Lunenburg, which is the bordering county to Mecklenburg. Mecklenburg is actually where the hospital was that I was born in. Same difference, though. I mean, you're talking rural Virginia. I grew up raised by grandparents on a tobacco farm. So it was farming. It was, you know, working in the woods, sawmilling. It was small town rural America. My grandparents who raised me, my grandfather was born in 1914. Grandmother was born in 1919. So, you know, they saw a lot. but they got me up every morning to feed the pigs. My grandfather used to say, if the pigs don't eat, you don't eat, right? So that's what I did. I got up in the morning, I fed the pigs and went to school and, you know, I played sports and came home and worked in the tobacco field and did chores. It was small town rural America. It was the foundation of everything that I've done since.
Was this a family farm, and do you all still have the farm?
So it was my family farm. It was my grandparents' farm, and we still have the land and the property. Mm-hmm. So okay. my grandparents are both deceased, but we're not farming on it any longer.
How did you happen to major in political science in college?
Well, it goes back to that farm experience. You know, you and I were just talking about how warm it is in our respective places. Mm-hmm. When you're pulling tobacco in the middle of August and it's 100 degrees outside and you're in a tobacco field bent over pulling leaves from a stalk and snakes are crawling, what you aspire to is an office job. That's mm-hmm. what you aspire to. And so I was going to go to college and then I was going to go to law school. That was my plan. And so political science was the major that people that I asked told me, well, if you want to go to law school, then you should major in political science. And so that's what I did. And it was a great major for me because it was material that I was interested in. And I had some great professors in this small college that I went to. And it did give me some foundation for graduate school and law school afterwards.
Now, I'm proud to say I know two Rhodes Scholars. One was one of my high school classmates and you. Talk to us about that experience.
So who was your high school classmate?
William. And he went to Oxford in 1972.
Okay, so he was after me.
Right.
Oh, he was before me. Look, so here's the deal, right? You're talking about a country boy from a small town of 1,200 people, raised by grandparents who died never having traveled on an airplane. Mm. You talking about that same little country boy now studying at a global university like Oxford and being in a different country. It literally changed my life. I mean, it made me a citizen of the world. I ended up studying and being taught by people from all over the globe and making friendships with people from all over the globe and studying in a system that literally you're going one-on-one with your tutor, and your tutor's job is to prepare you for passing exams. It's a completely different system. It's an international context. It's a university that is older than the U.S., much older than the U.S. And so, yeah, it changed my life. And in fact, from there, I was able to travel to other parts of Europe and travel to South America and do other traveling. So for a little country boy from a town of 1,200, it was a completely different world, and it definitely transformed my life.
How did that experience have an effect on you as a young man today?
You know, I think it had an effect on me in a couple of ways. One, it did make me much more aware of the fact that I was living in a global community, not just Virginia or the United States. So it mm-hmm. definitely made me more aware of and more curious about what was going on in any place on the planet. That's number one. Number two, it also gave me a chance to see the U.S. from outside of it and through the eyes of people who were not Americans. And it gave me a chance to see good stuff, but it also gave me a chance to see things that we needed to improve in. And so it really did give me just a more complex view of our country and the world that that we live in, and that has shaped who I am today.
Why was it important for you to obtain a law degree?
You know, it's interesting. When I was in the eighth grade, I got a chance to become a page in the Virginia General Assembly, which, again, big deal for a little country boy. But when I went down and worked in the General Assembly, what I saw was all these legislators had law degrees. And so I concluded as a 13-year-old that, okay, if I wanted to help people, then I needed to get a law degree. And so I concluded as an eighth grader that that's what I wanted to do. And I stayed pretty wedded to that even through grad school when I was thinking, well, maybe what I should do is go get a PhD and try to be a professor or something. I still believed that what I wanted and what I could get from that law degree was an ability to be more analytical in my thinking and problem solving, and also a credential that would allow me to do the sort of things that I wanted to do in the public sector and the private sector. And so that's why I maintained that desire to get that law degree and then went on to law school. And it has been, for me, a very, very beneficial credential.
How did you happen to become the 16th Virginia Secretary of Commerce?
I worked for the governor of Virginia, who's now one of Virginia's U.S. senators, Mark Warner. And I was his deputy chief of staff, and then I was his commissioner of the Department of Social Services. Well, when Governor McAuliffe was elected, one of the persons he appointed, in fact, it was eventually his chief of staff, was a gentleman with whom I had worked in Governor Warner's administration. And so this guy called me up and said, hey, do you have any interest in coming back and working in Virginia state government for a second time around? Well, since, you know, it's my home and it was a chance to do public service in my home, I jumped on it. And when he told me about the Commerce and Trade Secretary, where you basically get up every day 24/7 trying to figure out how to bring more jobs to urban and rural Virginia, I jumped on it because it was a chance to, you know, work on behalf of rural Virginia and on behalf of urban and metropolitan Virginia, and a chance to really focus on jobs. And, you know, that for me was an easy sell. So, but it came about largely because I had previous experience working in Virginia state government.
Now, we can't leave out your involvement with the Obama administration in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Did you get a call from the president or someone close to him when you were selected?
So it's interesting. The call actually came from folks in the White House who were vetting candidates for the job. And ultimately what happened was I went up and interviewed, and the last person that I interviewed with on the day that they invited me in was Valerie Jarr. Mm-hmm. And so she really was quite influential in my ultimately getting the opportunity to do that job.
I'm glad you mentioned that as the next question is, how important is for individuals, particularly young individuals, growing up to try to do the straight and narrow because you never know what the future is going to hold?
Look, it's critical. It's critical for a lot of reasons. You mentioned one. You don't know what the future is going to hold, and you don't know what you're going to be aspiring to do. And you also don't know who's, you know, who's looking at you and modeling their lives off of, or their life off of your life. And so, yeah, it is always important to try to be good, right? You're not going to be perfect, right? I've made many mistakes in my life. But it's important to try to be good both for yourself, but also for others who you may be influencing and don't even know it. And so that's what I tell folks all the time. And, you know, when you're living, you're not just living for you. You're first of all, you're part of a story. And there were people who came before you, and you're carrying out their story, so you've got that responsibility. And secondly, you want to go as far as you can in your life. And then thirdly, you got others who you may not know it, but they're watching you, and they're aspiring to do things or emulate you in some ways. And so we don't live in isolation. We live in a context, and we need to embrace what comes with it.
Yeah, I understand. We'll be back with more in Black America after this message. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Maurice A. Jones, Esquire, CEO and President of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, former Deputy Undersecretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and former Secretary of Commerce in Virginia. Mr. Jones, look like you are doing great things with the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Tell us about it.
Well, LISC has been around for about 40 years. I tell people all the time, we're in the opportunity business, right? We invest loans and grants and equity and technical assistance in those things that help people in places achieve economic and social mobility. So we invest in creating and preserving affordable housing. We invest in launching and strengthening small businesses. And we invest in schools and charter schools and football fields and in low wealth areas and workforce training. Right? That's what we do for a living. We use a business model, but the return is fighting poverty. It's catalyzing opportunity. It's opening doors for people to places that are underinvested or disinvested. And in 40 years' time, we've invested about $22 billion in these places and these people, and we've leveraged about $65 billion. And so we are, you know, gratified by that work. I will tell you there is just much more of it to be done. And so we are committed to aggressively pursuing this mission every day.
How has this pandemic intensified what you all do?
Yeah, it's really intensified it because the pandemic, as most people are learning, has had disproportionate adverse impacts on people and places, right? The people in places hardest hit by this have been black and brown folks in low-wealth communities. And those are the places that we specialize on. Those are the places that we focus on. And so those places have needed us to do more. So we have raised $100 million to provide small grants to small businesses to the tune of $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 per grant. And 95% of those grants have gone to businesses that are led by people of color, black and brown folks, Latinx, African-American folks. Over 65% of those grant dollars have gone to businesses led by women. About 80% of those are to businesses working in low-wealth communities. So this pandemic has really called on us to help nonprofits and for-profit small businesses, particularly those in the communities where we work. It has called on us to do more to help them face what is an existential threat. And so we've spent a lot of time doing that. But in addition to that, you we have about 2,000 plus nonprofit partners around the country who are doing various things: workforce development, housing development, relief payments, food pantries, you name it. And this pandemic has really, really called on us to try to raise as much capital as we can and then get it to them as quickly as we can get it, so that they can be more helpful in the communities where they serve. And so we are busier now than we've ever been.
How does these nonprofit and these businesses get in touch with you, or there are other organizations that you all work through?
Well, so we have, LISC has, so LISC is a national company. We have headquarters in New York City, but we have 36 offices around the country.
Okay.
So those local offices are in the communities with relationships, and people know to reach out to them. Additionally, in rural America, we have a network of about 100 partners through which we work. And again, those partners are right there in the communities, in the counties, in the rural areas, and people reach us through them as well. And then in addition to that, LISC has subsidiary companies. We have a company that does new markets tax credits, and we have a company that does low-income housing tax credits. And we have a company that's exclusively focused on loans to small businesses. So we've got a network of 3,000 partners nationwide through which people reach us. We also can be reached just through our website at www.list.org. So our motto is, be present, be proximate in the communities to the people and the places that we want to serve, and that's why we have this national footprint that I just described.
Talk to us about these individuals and corporations that have been so generous.
Yeah, it's been really, really gratifying. I mean, we've had, generosity from individuals like Mackenzie Scott, who provided us a $40 million unrestricted grant to help our work. Companies like Verizon, who provided a $7.5 million plus grant. Netflix, who recently came in at $25 million for us to provide access to capital to Black-led financial institutions, banks, credit unions, CDFIs, et cetera. We've had companies like Walmart and Sam's Club provide grants for small businesses. Lowe's provided us with a $60 million grant that we're turning around and serving small businesses with a focus on, as I said, Black-led businesses, people of color-led businesses, businesses in rural areas. So companies have really, really stepped up in this moment. And as a result, we have been able to, by the time this year is over, we will have, because of the largesse of these companies, provided something north of $200 million in grants and forgivable loans to small businesses, for-profit and not-for-profit, throughout the country.
Dealing with such large sums of money, how much scrutiny are you all under?
Well, we're always under scrutiny from different places, right? So investors want to see results. They also want to make sure that we are dotting our I's and crossing our T's, so we're not putting them at risk from a reputation standpoint. We always have auditors in auditing our books. We are a S&P rated company, so we're a AA- rated company by S&P. And so S&P, as a result, comes in every year and reviews and scrutinizes our portfolio, amongst other things. We get monies from public sector, the federal government, HUD, Treasury, Labor Department, plus state and local city governments, and they also do their own oversight and auditing. So we are scrutinized intensively from multiple sources, and frankly, all of that makes us better. So the comments, the feedback, the oversight, you know, I once had a professor who said to me, he said, "You know what your conscience is, Mr. Jones?" And I said, "What?" He said, it's the knowledge that I'm watching you. And so the knowledge that all of these people are watching us helps our conscience in a big, big way. So we're better because people are watching us. And so we're grateful.
I understand. Looking at the reality of it, knowing that you can't help everyone, what do you see or foresee the landscape of businesses, particularly African-American and women-owned businesses, after this pandemic has somewhat subsided?
Yeah. So I think the pandemic has highlighted at least a couple of areas that we are going to try to really, really intensify our efforts around when it comes to small businesses, particularly small businesses led by Blacks and people of color. One is technology. And I would tell you that's a huge one. And what I mean by that is the pandemic has taught us all that no matter your size or where you are, if you are a business, for-profit or not-for-profit, you need to be able to provide your services and your products via the internet, via some kind of technology. You need an e-commerce play, if you will. And so we want to help more businesses develop and sustain an e-commerce platform, because there's no question in our mind that was a necessary ingredient before this pandemic, but the pandemic has just, you know, made that a closed and shut case.
Maurice A. Jones, President and CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs on KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archives of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchive.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Henson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.